Hi, everybody. How are you? How is you doing? I'm a paid communicator. Everybody sleep well with our crazy little thing we do with the clocks? You guys doing well? Good. The ushers are going to come forward. If you came to prepared already in mind that you wanted to partner financially with what God is doing in and through this community, not just on Sundays, but every day of the week and locally and globally, it's one of the ways that we entrust what matters to each other and to God. And so if you came prepared already to do that, that's what the bag going by is about. While they're doing that, we're going to dive right in. If you're new with us, we are studying the book of Mark. We've been doing it all year and going through everything that Jesus says, to whom and where and why, studying all of that. Not because we can do that exhaustively, but because we want to learn, to see if there's still something we can learn on the other side of the planet 2 millennia later in a different language. And so it's been very fascinating. In the past couple of weeks, we've gotten to what's been called the I'll say it. Give me a second. I've already done this twice, so I'm trying to coax my brain into one more time. The Last Supper, it's a Seder, a Passover Seder that they have. And then Judas Iscariot and his betrayal, that the gears of that betrayal are already in motion. And so that's what we've discussed for the last couple of weeks. And that brings us to this week, chapter 14 of the book of Mark. They came to a place named Gethsemane. And Jesus said to his disciples, to his students, sit here until I have prayed. And so they've gotten up from dinner, and they have gone out to Gethsemane. And he tells them, stay here until I've prayed. Then he takes with him Peter and James and John. This is the inner circle of the circle. And he began to be very distressed and troubled. And Jesus said to them, my soul is deeply grieved. That Greek word can be literally translated distressed, troubled, agitated. And then it's got some adjectives in place that make it beyond just, hey, this makes me sad. I am really troubled. I am deeply troubled to the point of death. I feel like I could die right now. Stay here and keep watch. So they get up from dinner. He walks with the 12. He tells them to stay, but then points, you, and you, come with me. And then goes further into Gethsemane, and he says, I am doing very badly right now. I am so stressed out, I feel like I could die. Pray. I'm going to go pray. You stay here, keep watch. You pray. Now, Gethsemane is an Aramaic word. It means the place of pressing. We don't know whose garden it is. It's not likely it's any of theirs. They're in some friend's garden. It's an olive garden. This is back before you could get unlimited breadsticks there. I pretty much gave all my attention to that joke, so the rest of the message is downhill from there. So I couldn't work in the, like, when you're here, you're the Messiah. I couldn't make that work, so. See, it didn't work. That's why I warned you. I shouldn't have even said it. So they're in a place called the place of pressing. And so it's a garden of olives. When you press an olive, that's where you get olive oil used in all kinds of different ways. We've discussed some of that over the last couple of months. But Jesus is also figuratively in the place of pressing. That's what's so brilliant about where this whole scene is located. Jesus has the betrayal that he knows has started. It's just in his recent past. Jesus knows he's at the end of his 3-year ministry. He's got to be thinking there are still so many things I could do. There are so many things that didn't come together the way maybe that I would like for them to. He's got his past, but then he's got what's going to happen, and now it's not days anymore. It's in the next couple of hours. I will be arrested. I will be beaten, punched in the face, beard torn out, spat upon, then put on mock trial, then tortured, and then nailed while still alive to a tree. This is a place of pressing where that which is behind and that which is before are like plates, constricting and pressing and pressing and pressing. And I wonder if you'd be willing to admit that this is a good description of the human experience. That there are seasons where things are going pretty well, but and maybe it's just a vacation, but for the most part, it's just a matter of scale. That which is before and that which is behind provokes and pushes and constricts and presses, sometimes leading you to say, I'm so deeply distressed right now, I feel like I could die. But we have a book and we have a speaker or a sermon or a song or a movie, a story, a phrase, a bumper sticker that we like to use to push back in this fight. You have your own words, but the thesis of it is don't quit. Fight, fight, fight. When you have pressure coming at you, you've got pressure behind. Don't give up. Fight, fight, fight. Don't quit. I want to try something. I've tried this before. I'm going to ask for a volunteer, but don't be afraid. Let's see. It's all tangled up. I love it. Everybody's looking at their knees. I don't exist, Doherty. Keep walking. Okay, sir? Good to have you. Hold on. Whatever you do, don't let go. Okay? Okay. All right. You can let go now. Simon says. All right. Here you go. Whatever you do, don't let go. Okay. All right. Let's see. Sir, whatever you do, don't let go. Good. Very good. Okay. So we'll come back to that. Next verse. My soul is so distressed, I could die. Stay here. Keep watch. Pray. And he went a little beyond them and fell to the ground and began to pray that if it were possible, the hour might pass him by. Mark is telling you what happened. He went on into the garden and then prayed, he says, that the hour, that this moment could pass him by. But he doesn't just want to tell you. He wants you to hear Jesus say it. So he doesn't just tell you. Then he quotes him. And Jesus was saying, Abba, Father, everything's possible for you. So remove this cup from me. That's just an ancient way of saying, don't make me take this on. Don't make me do this. Take this cup from me. Yet not what I will, but what you will. The problem with this text is that we read it like it's text. You have to allow yourself to almost think theatrically about this. Jesus is out in a garden. And Mark says, so he goes out there and he asks to get out of it. So here's how he says it. And the first word is Aramaic for daddy. Abba. He's not just referencing his prayer manual, since I start Christianity. What did I write about this moment? He cries out into the night, daddy, father, papa, you can do anything. Don't make me do this. And you can't just keep reading. You've got to stop and recognize that these two sentences are probably divided by 15 minutes. You could do anything. There's got to be another way. If there's any way around this, I'll take it. Daddy knelt down in a garden. Now, the other gospel accounts, they record Jesus as being so stressed out. It says that he was sweating drops of blood. What is actually occurring is blood is making its way through soft tissue, that you're so anxious that your body chemistry begins to break down soft tissue and blood starts to come out of your pores. Jesus is stressed. Jesus is very, very stressed. And he's kneeling down, crying out into the dark, Daddy, I don't want to do this, but not my will, yours be done. Next verse. And he came and he found them sleeping and said to Peter, Simon, are you asleep? Couldn't you keep watch for 1 hour? Keep watching and praying that you won't come into temptation. The spirit is willing, but the flesh is weak. I know you want this. I know your spirit wants this. It's the flesh working against you. Now, This is an interesting moment. One, in defense of the disciples, because Jesus is crying out and he's praying, and then he comes back and he finds his inside circle asleep. They did just go through a Passover Seder, which requires all participants to drink 4 cups of wine. So they're probably a little groggy from that. But what I find really interesting is that towards the beginning of Mark, everybody's in a boat and a storm comes and the boat starts to slosh and to list, and the disciples start to cry out, "We're going to die." And Jesus is asleep in the stern and they shake Jesus awake. "We're going to die. Don't you care?" And Jesus goes shh to the storm and shh to the disciples and says, "Why do you have such little faith?" And now Jesus is facing the storm of his life, and he goes to Peter, "Are you sleeping?" And I can almost imagine Peter waking up and going, "Where's your faith?" Now, I want to walk real carefully through this, but I want to ask the question, is it hypocrisy? Maybe. But I can tell you that the disciples weren't going to die. They were just being scared. Jesus knows, I'm not getting out of this. This isn't a scary storm. I'm anticipating my demise. But over all of that, we can hear Jesus saying in multiple ways at the same time, never fall asleep in Gethsemane. I know it's easier to sleep through Gethsemane, the place of pressure, the place of constriction. The body will tell you, let's just sleep through this. Never sleep through Gethsemane. Next verse. Again, Jesus went away and prayed, saying the same words. He does it again. Daddy! You ever pray about something? Somebody tells you to pray about something. You pray about it, and then later you're like, well, that didn't help. Or you feel really good after you pray, and then you don't get the job. See, for Jesus, he goes right back out into the woods, and he says the same thing because it's not resolved. Because prayer is not an event. It's not a thing you do. It's a way that you live. That's why Paul, decades later, would say, pray ceaselessly. Which he was, if he meant literally, he was disobeying himself by writing it. I should be praying right now, but I'm going to write this. Prayer is a way of continuing to come to God, to be honest with yourself and God, to say, here's all the ways I'm pushing against what you want. Here's what I want. You take a step in confidence, and then you step back in confidence. And then you take a step in confidence, and then you step away from that confidence. Jesus goes right back out and says all the same things again. Next verse. And again, he came and found them sleeping. Their eyes were heavy. They didn't know what to answer him this time. That's a comical scene. And he came the third time and said to them, "Are you still sleeping and resting?" And then takes a deep breath and says, "It's enough. The hour has come. Behold, the Son of Man is being betrayed into the hands of sinners. So get up. Let's be going. Behold, the one who's betraying me is at hand." And suddenly you can hear footsteps, and suddenly the sides of the olive plants and the trees, the trunks of trees, are lit by torch fire. And here comes Judas and the detachment of soldiers coming up the hill to arrest Jesus. And so the question you might ask is, well, did the prayer work? Because I don't think anybody ever meant a prayer as much as Jesus meant that one. Did the prayer work? Did the disciples work? Granted, they slept through a lot of it, but they did do some praying. Did the prayer work? Does prayer work? I want to step really carefully into, but when I say carefully, I mean respectfully. It's nothing to be feared. I want to make sure that I don't seem to be playing fast and loose with some really sacred ideas. So I want to step respectfully into some of what we're going to talk about now. And the reason for that is when you look at the gospel and you look at what Mark is trying to do, these are the final moments of Jesus' life. Now, all the gospel writers, they agree that this happened. The gospel writers, they record different words, similar words, different stories, similar stories. This story that seems to contradict this story. And lots of fascinating conversation comes from that. But they all agree that the trajectory of Jesus' teaching and his miracles, his life, culminates in terms of the reason for writing the gospel in his death and his burial and his resurrection. So Mark is writing this gospel, and Mark is running out of ink, and he's running out of papyrus, and he wants very specific things in your head as this story comes to a close. And what are the pictures that were being presented about this Jesus? This Jesus in the moments before his death. And as I've considered that, I'm stuck asking, what is Jesus Christ, the Son of God, actually controlling in this moment? What is he really controlling? He's knelt down in a garden crying out, Abba, Daddy. I would argue that that's an emotional pry bar, that it borders on manipulative, that I'm not just saying God, but I'm crying out like a young boy, please. And you know what that's like. You've been in a stressful situation where your prayers became way less rote and more the pleading of a child. I'm begging you. I'm desperate. He's prying on God. And Mark records no words from God. No words from heaven. Silence. It's mute. Heaven is mute. Nothing. What is Jesus controlling? He's trying to get God to respond, to cater to what feels very real to him, and he won't do it. Jesus can't control his body. His body is literally breaking down to the point where he's sweating blood. He can't control his emotions. He's telling his inside circle, I feel like I could die right now. Have you ever been around somebody that's that anxious, they can't breathe? I could die right where I'm standing right now. I am so stressed. I'm hurting so bad inside. It's to the point of death. Where their temper starts to shorten. They start to run out of patience. He can't control his friends. His best friends are knocked out. You're sleeping? Did you hear me crying? Sorry. He can't control his friends, and he can't control his enemies. He doesn't even know when his friends might become enemies. His enemies have showed up. His friends are about to split in about a dozen different directions to save their own tails. He can't control his destiny, this thing that's just marching toward him, just like the end of the gospel. Here it comes. Here it comes. You know this day was going to come. Here it comes. He can't control religion. Religion has actually sent these soldiers to arrest him. He can't control politics. He's actually going to have to deal with, within the next 12 hours, the governor of the area on behalf of the Roman Empire. He can't control the pain that's coming. There's no way around the pain, the emotional, physical, psychological pain that's coming. What is Jesus in control of? I would say nothing. Now, a person of faith would push back on that. They may push back on that because many of us, we have been taught that when you talk about Jesus Christ, you want to make sure that you understand him in the context of all powerful and knowing and being able to do whatever. And so a lot of people would hear me say that and say, no, he had control. He could have done anything. And then so you can quote some verses about that. That at one point, Jesus says, you know that I could call an entire legion of angels to fight for me right now. That later when he faces Pilate, he says, you don't take my life, I lay it down. You can say that he could have done anything. My response is, could we? No. You and I, as human beings, wouldn't have access to any of that miraculous stuff that Jesus could have done. And the second Jesus calls on a miracle, he departs with the human experience. But instead, the God-man, who then necessarily is the man-God, in full alignment with the human experience, calls on none of that. It's not at his disposal. The second it is, he is not aligned with the human experience. He's not, as the scriptures insist, taking on our life, taking on our pain, bearing our stripes. In full solidarity with humanity, he doesn't. Because to be human, to be a real human, is to never really have control much. In fact, to be human is to not even have control of when you get to control stuff. The human experience is one where, despite all appearances, there's very little that you're controlling. And Jesus is 100% aligned with that in his final moments before his death. There's seemingly nothing on heaven in heaven or on earth that Jesus can control. And a lack of control is exactly what makes you and I fight. You and I hate not having control. So we fight. Everything is a fight when you understand life to be about control. And hear me on this. What I'm saying is you're fighting for something that you never really have. You're anxious for something that you can't get. And so many of us spend our entire existence fighting for something we've never actually experienced. It's an illusion. So much so that fighting is assumed. Fighting is a baseline operating in all kinds of scenarios and situations where it's not necessary, where it's actually making things worse. That we assume fight when it really has nothing to do with fighting. That's how deeply ingrained it is in us. Whatever you do, don't let go. Why won't you just come with me? Why won't he just come with me? I just said, don't let go. I ain't losing this. Don't feel bad. We all do it. You can let go. Simon says, why would we do that? Why would we hear that and assume it means don't lose? When all I was doing is, it was just another way of inviting somebody to come with me. But we assume challenge. We assume conflict. We run on a baseline of fighting, fighting, fighting. And Jesus doesn't fight, but he also doesn't lose. He surrenders. And I would argue that surrender is the least attractive thing that you could ever be presented in this culture. Look at the definition of surrender. To agree to stop fighting, hiding, resisting, etc., because you know you're not going to win or succeed. To give the control or use of something to someone else. Yeah, sign me up for that. That sounds good. There's nothing less attractive in our culture than surrender. To give control away. To accept that I'm not going to win. In a culture that says, don't quit. Fight, fight, fight. When you hear a guy up on stage with a Bible saying, you should surrender, what we turn it into is, okay, I'll go to church. I'll take some words out of my vocabulary. I'll pray before I eat. But it's my life. It's my money. It's my future. They're my kids. It's my reputation. Jesus teaches us that this isn't winning and it's not losing. It's this third space in between where it's a totally different way of succeeding. There are times in our life where you must fight, but those times are far fewer than you and I could ever imagine. Far fewer than you and I are comfortable with. There are times where you got to push, where you must resist, where something needs revoked, where something needs challenged, but those times are far fewer than you and I could ever imagine. What Jesus is reminding us or teaching us is that some of the most significant moments in human history, some of the most significant, most profound moments in your story come from you realizing you got to stop fighting. Some of the most profound moments in human history are people recognizing when it's time to stop fighting. But that doesn't mean quitting. It doesn't mean giving up. It's not spiritual to become apathetic. That's where it gets misunderstood, and that's why it gets ignored. Jesus is not apathetic. Jesus, if he would have fought, would have broken the whole story down. But if Jesus had run away, it also would have broken the whole story down. What I'm saying is Jesus exhibits profound courage in surrender. Surrendering to mute heaven, surrendering to pain, surrendering to misunderstanding, surrendering to obscurity, surrendering, and embracing a totally different kind of success. And it's easy for us on the other side of the cross, the other side of the resurrection, we know how the story goes, and so we know how that was going to pay off. But that's not how our lives work. And that's what I'm up against this morning. One is trying to tell you that what I'm learning about this is emotional. And so when you give words to it, you mess it up a little bit. This emotional understanding, this pulling back on this emotion to constantly fight and challenge and push and resist, to give it words, it limits it significantly. The other thing that I found that I'm up against this morning is that I am resisting the urge to sell this idea to you, especially my brothers in the room. That's to say, take nothing from my sisters in the room, but grown men saying, oh, I'm not going to surrender. Did you see the definition? Because what I want to do is sell surrender as it's this thing you do that pays off really well. Like, don't worry about the amount of money this costs you now. You get triple back. Oh, okay, it's an investment. Don't worry about doing this thing because on the other side of it, then it'll be like heaven on the other side. I'm not saying those things are false or bad. What I'm saying is they cater to the broken part of us that must be reassured that we'll win. If I'm delaying a win, that's still a win, right? Jesus isn't trying to enhance that part of us. This is a third space that lives in the middle. This isn't winning. This isn't losing. This is recognizing a different sort of success that trusts, though I'm not getting any feedback from God, though those around me are turning out to be disappointment, that my path leads straight through pain. I can't get around it. Straight into a cross. Understand they had to invent a word to describe the pain. Excruciating. Excrucius from the cross. It hurts that bad. That there is a way of saying, this will be excruciating to submit and surrender to something that gives me no promise, that gives me no guarantees. In fact, I know that he, she, they are wrong, and yet I still am out of options because to fight isn't going to help it, and to quit isn't an option. I surrender. I surrender. I surrender. Jesus shows us that it's the most courageous thing to do. It doesn't take any courage to fight because most of your fighting will be impulse. That's just instinct. It doesn't take a lot of courage most of the time to fight. And it certainly doesn't take courage to run away and avoid the whole thing. It takes courage to face pain and submit to it, to face ambiguity and doubt and submit, to surrender to it. It takes a profound amount of courage. And that courage, it comes from a mindful awareness of when it's time to fight and most likely when it's time to surrender. And this mindfulness that we get serves as a recognition that our baseline is conflict. That will turn anything into fighting. And if we're more aware of that, if we begin to assume, be aware of our assumptions, that down deep underneath words, that we are hearing conflict where there isn't one, where we can misunderstand a simple invitation to come with as something to win, then we begin to be mindful enough to stop and ask good questions. And here's one. What am I really fighting for? What am I really fighting for? Because I fight well and I fight passionately. But what am I really fighting for? I talk to couples a lot and they'll talk about fighting for their marriage. They'll talk about fighting to be understood, fixing and reconciling and making sure that things are properly explained and fighting and fighting, fighting. And what you have is somebody fighting for peace. That is to say, somebody fighting and thinking that war isn't going to be the outcome of their fighting. You have people that don't recognize they're saying, this is how it's going to be and I'm going to fight for it and that's how, and you're making it worse. You're breaking him. You're breaking her. To ask yourself, well, what am I really fighting for? And oftentimes it's, I don't want to be alone. Now we know what we're doing. That's something very different. Now you're fighting to protect yourself. I don't want to end up like my parents. I see. Underneath the nobility of fighting, what you're really doing is defending yourself. I don't want to be in pain. I don't want to hurt. I don't want to be lonely. I don't want to feel stupid. I don't want to admit I'm wrong. That's a whole different thing. Sometimes by fighting, you make it worse because you're not fighting for what you even tell yourself. You're fighting about. People fight for businesses and for causes. And we're going to make this thing happen, and it needs to happen. It'll be good, it'll be good, it'll be good. But it's marked by anxiety. It's marked by division. It's marked by counting your success by the failure of others. And suddenly you realize, we're not fighting for what I said we're fighting for. I'm just trying not to lose. I'm just trying not to disappoint. I'm scared. That's a totally different thing. You'll find there's far less reason to fight than our culture teaches us. Jesus is teaching us over and over some of the most profound moments in history, some of the most profound things in our lives are marked by knowing when to stop fighting and to surrender. It's a difficult thing to willingly submit yourself to a cross. It's a difficult thing to willingly give yourself away, to relinquish control. But I am finding, and this has not resolved in my life, I am finding in my life that the anxiety that I carry, this angst, this desire to fight, it comes from, like many of us, it comes from a lifetime of hoping I don't lose. I don't want to be the guy behind in education. I don't want to be behind on getting the joke. I don't want to be behind financially. I want to make sure I came from and I'm headed to all the right places. And everything has been this competition, fight, 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 fight. And so when I hear Christ inviting me to surrender, I'm hearing more my words, my definitions than his. And so Christ in his final moments teaches perhaps one of his greatest lessons, that surrender isn't losing, nor is it winning. It's the human experience of trust, of relinquishing that which you actually never held, control, forcing you to think communally, forcing you to live at peace with each other. And so then you find, oh, if I fight, I'm supposed to fight for others, not fight against them. The only fight that I have left in me is the legs of love. It's how you make love more than mere sentiment. I fight for others. And I ask the question over and over, what am I really fighting for? Am I defending myself? Am I scared? Am I trying to avoid pain? You keep asking the question, you find all that's left to fight for is those who need fought for. That's what gives love its legs. So in our last couple of minutes, I want to pray, and Stephen's going to lead us in just a couple moments of music. And what we're going to do is just create just a little bit of space to let God paint faces in our heads. Who are the people you're fighting against? Maybe your own face comes up. Maybe it's parents, siblings, a spouse, a would-be spouse. Maybe it's coworkers, whoever it is. God will throw some faces up, perhaps. Maybe some words that have been said to you or that you have said. And to just begin asking the question, what am I fighting? What am I really fighting with them, with that, about? What is really going on? And to allow God to redefine surrender, not as something intended to break you so that you could call yourself spiritual, but a totally different way of succeeding. Let's take a few moments. God, we're jarred a bit at Mark's depiction of Christ's final moments before death. Many of us have grown up thinking that we were to talk only of Christ as a superhero, and anything less than that somehow was blasphemy. And yet Mark, in the end of his gospel, paints Jesus as uncomfortably human, uncomfortably like us, resolved that people and you and society and religion and ideas and even our own thoughts and feelings about things, control about all that comes and goes, and mostly goes. So God, for my brothers and sisters gathered here today, would we be somehow encouraged to see surrender as something beautiful?
that we'd be realistic about it, that what we're not being told is that surrender gets us around pain, or that surrender absolves us of doubt and the difficulty of wrestling with reality. In fact, it's much the opposite. As we understand it, God, it's surrender to the things we've spent so much of our energy trying to avoid, trying to conquer or run from. God, we come to you in these moments, and hopefully for all the moments after, asking real questions about what we fight, who we fight, why we fight, to take our cues from the crucified one who promised life, real human life. To the best of our abilities, we thank you for Gethsemane, for the pressure behind and before that makes us real men and women, the ones you dreamt up long ago.
To Jesus I surrender, all to him I freely give. I will ever love and trust him, in his presence daily live. I surrender all to Jesus. I surrender humbly at your feet. I bow, worldly pleasures all forsaken. Take me, Jesus.
You guys have a great week.